ahead with this. State Interim Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Hearings on all of our committee bills and a couple other bills today. And because we have a lot of business, we're going to get started. Hopefully the rest of our committee will get here shortly. We changed the agenda order a little bit so people know, because we have some people that have to scurry back to Tillamook County. And we want to make sure that they can do everything in their lives instead of just part of it. So we appreciate people being here. So we're going to open this informational hearing on RV fees, LC 156, and we're going to also open the Salmonberry Trail, LC 152, at the same time so that people can make some comments, and then we'll come back to that one in due time. But with that, we will open both those informational hearings. And with that, welcome to our committee. We got to do this a little bit last session, and now we're going to hopefully get ready to start this session, and I think we'll start with Beth Johnson.
I'm actually going to defer to my two colleagues. I'm the cheering section in this one.
Okay, very good. So whoever wants to start.
Let's start.
Good morning, Senator Roland, members of the committee, Lisa Van Lannen, interim director for Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Thanks for having us here today. We're here today to support the declaration of cooperation that was achieved through the Oregon Solutions process. OPRD recognizes that many counties around the state are dealing with financial hardships and struggling with determining how they're going to continue to deliver public services at the same levels they have in the past. We are here today show our support and cooperation with the agreement, and I'd like to thank Commissioner Labhart and the Association of Counties for their good dialogue and their commitment to future relationships as we work through this process. I also want to thank John Potter from our office for his work on the cooperation agreement. We believe that the conversations that have been started will create a greater pathway and a door to collaborative conversations for OPRD and the Association of Counties and all recreation providers across the state to start having dialogues about similar issues we're all facing around funding and around service delivery, and that we can create unique solutions that will serve all recreation providers and visitors in the state of Oregon. So thanks for having us here today.
Senator Roblin, Chair, Senator, good morning. For the record, my name is Mark Labhart, and I am currently a Tillamook County Commissioner. I'm in my third term. I also serve on the Legislative Committee for the Association of Oregon Counties and on the Board of Directors of Association of Oregon Counties, and I am speaking on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties today in support of this LC. As Senator Roblin knows most well, we had some hiccups in the last legislative session. There was a commitment during the last legislative session through a budget notes that were directed to the State Parks Department to begin negotiations with the county on the resolution of this RV registration bill. And I would I'm happy to report that we had an Oregon Solutions process where we brought the parties to the table. The governor's office was in attendance, state parks, the counties, and representatives from Oregon Solutions. It was a very good process. We came out of that with a declaration of cooperation signed by Tim Wood, the state parks director, Brad, I think it's pronounced Chalfont, who is a state parks commissioner, and the Association of Oregon Counties, myself, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And Greg Wolf from the governor's office was in attendance for part of the meetings and has indicated that the governor is in very strong support of this LC. So I don't know how much detail you'd like us to go into. We've reached agreement. You have a draft in front of us. The Association of Oregon Counties supports that draft. I believe State Park supports that draft. The governor's office supports that draft. Senator Johnson is a strong supporter of this. It will help us in the counties to achieve a significant reduction in the backlog of maintenance for county parks. You may or may not know this, but about roughly 50% of the parks in the state of Oregon are county parks, county sites, and roughly 50% of the sites are state. So the counties do have a large stake in the parks program. And in addition to this LC, We are working, the Association of Oregon Counties and Parks, are working on collaboratively at possibility of trading sites back and forth. There are some places where state parks would not rather, maybe it's an isolated parcel, would not rather manage that park, but maybe the counties would. They're, and vice versa. An example in my county, we have a small county park called Whalen Island. That's right next to a fairly large state park. And should both of us be managing the same piece of ground? Probably not. And so State Parks is interested in possibly acquiring that. So we are looking cooperatively at how we can be more efficient and effective in parks management. So besides the RV registration bill, we're looking at opportunities to be more efficient and effective on how we manage parks. So unless there's detailed questions, I'd be glad to answer those, but unless there's detailed questions, I'm done.
I'm here to put the exclamation point on this. Last session, as Commissioner indicated, we thought we were close. We ended up with only getting a budget note, have achieved all the elements of the budget note. But this is testimony, in my opinion, to how well the Oregon Solutions and, by extension, the Regional Solutions process works. We used the very skilled services of Eric Lindauer as the mediator. It put people that didn't start out agreeing in the same room, worked through their differences, found out those things that they could agree on, and moves forward with a kumbaya concept that comes before you today with everyone in agreement. It's a fine piece of legislation, and I hope the committee acts favorably on it.
So I guess I'll do this just because I need to ask. We thought we did pretty well last session, and then it went to Ways and Means. Is there any need for us to show up at hearings with regard to that in the coming days, weeks, and months?
Mr. Chair, what I've learned in this process is it ain't over till it's over. And I hope that through my connection with Ways and Means that I can prevail on the co-chairs to understand that this is one of these rare instances where everybody now is in agreement and presents to the legislature a good concept with universal accord on the bill.
Well, keep us informed if we need to show up. And again, this is one of the three committee bills we have, and that we will pre-file probably the end of this week if our committee agrees to it. So that's the reason why we need the majority of the committee, is to have a vote at the end of this deal on the bills that we want to send forward from as committee bills. And this is one of those. Yes?
Mr. Chair, I want to apologize to the presenters, traffic. I think Senator Close, I think both of us kind of got caught up in the Mission Street saga.
Thank you. Any other questions for this particular one? We are invited only, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we will close our public hearing on LC 156. And we've already opened LC 152 Salmon Bay, because I know there's some other people here that would like to speak to that one before they have to go. So we'll come back. We'll put this in a recess after you guys speak so that we can move back into the regular agenda. But if either of you would like to speak to Salmon Bay,
okay. Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. Some of this territory is encompassed in that Senate district. The Salmonberry is a remarkable opportunity to put Northwest Oregon on the national, if not the international, landscape in terms of trails. The genesis of this project starts with a horrific set of storms, first in 1996, when the railroad that connected Tillamook with the other side of the mountains was destroyed and rebuilt at a cost of $50 million. And then fast forward to 2007, when Mother Nature once again, and I think the state forester will have some pictures later to show you the power of the storm that raged through this area, and the railroad was once again destroyed. I think in an act of enormous political courage, the then Board of Commissioners of the Port of Tillamook Bay made the strategic decision not to rebuild the railroad. As a result, they were awarded some FEMA money that has helped to set the stage for looking at different alternatives. Because of the magnificent landscape in this area, because of the multiple uses, we are setting out to try to connect a trail that will accommodate equestrians, hikers, bicyclists through some of the most magnificent real estate in Oregon. The planning work is being done by Walker Macy, a renowned landscape architecture firm. Commissioner Labhart and I have attended numerous public meetings that are being held in banks, Willamette Wheeler to seek input, and it has been a robust public process. Some questions have arisen that we're slowly working through with respect to previous uses in this corridor, and I think that this has an opportunity to be the jewel in the crown of a series of trails that are connecting Northwest Oregon that will have international draw for people that are interested in using it. Already, even with the destruction that exists still in the corridor, in some of the extreme bicycling magazines, there are pictorials of people that are up in this area. So there is
snuck in.
Yes, spoken as only the state forest for a number of years could characterize it. But this is not only safety in that it will give an alternative for bicyclists to get off 101, where regrettably there have been deaths, but this will open up terrain and opportunities. We're going to try to accommodate all of the users, so it's conceivable that you could be in this area for a couple of days in an experiential horseback riding with accommodations for equine, and the communities are excited about it. I actually, a million years ago, when I was a working helicopter pilot, flew the course that created the Vernonia Linear Trail, and there was some naysaying about that. Now it is beloved, much used by the locals. As a result, there's been actual economic development, shops that cater to folks that are using that trail. This will be able to connect to that. This is just one in a series of magnificent recreation opportunities that are in the early planning stages. This will take decades to complete. We're well aware of that. We have formed avenues for private economic investment into it, and we bring it to the legislature for the 2014 session to introduce it, and I'm sure successive sessions over the biennial will hear more about it as it comes to be a reality. We urge your very strong support of it. It's a wonderful opportunity for Oregon.
Chair Weld, the members of the committee, again, for the record, Mark Labhart, Tillamook County Commissioner. I'm not sure I can say much else. This idea, I used to manage the Tillamook State Forest for about 20 years, and this idea has been talked about for a number of years since the Salmonberry was destroyed by the series of floods and windstorms and various rock slides and all those things. And there was a unique group that came together, Cycle Oregon, several of their board of directors, members of the Department of Forestry and State Parks and Tillamook County. We met in a kind of a executive session one day out at the Tillamook Interpretive Center to talk about this concept. And there seemed to be a lot of interest in maybe there was a way to be an opportunity to develop this area into a, as Senator Johnson said, not only an Oregon renowned site, but potentially an international renowned site for a trail from the valley to the coast, from Portland to the coast, a walking trail, a hiking trail. And we usually hear the term rails to trails nationwide. This is rails and trails. Rails and trails. A portion of the trail from Tillamook up to, right now, Wheeler is in fine shape. Well, I shouldn't say fine shape. It's in okay shape. But a scenic train is using that now. And the scenic train would like to go up to a little community called Enright. And so they would continue to use this site for a rail. But right alongside of it in the railroad right-of-way, there would be a trail. So you'd have dual use of this area from Enright to Tillamook. And then from Enright on over to Banks, it would be a trail through the Salmonberry. And potentially, there's some site on the other side near Banks that you could still have a train if you so wish. But we're talking about a dual use here for this site. So Cycle Oregon said, we're willing to contribute $50,000 of our money to help do this. State Parks stepped up and said they would contribute $50,000. The Department of Forestry stepped up and contributed $50,000 to begin the process of studying it. And I'd like to say, from a county perspective, I cannot thank the Department of Forestry and State Parks enough for their leadership in what they're doing to help this. M.G. Devereaux, Rocky now, Doug Decker has attended almost all the meetings personally, and the state forester is making time out of his busy schedule to attend these meetings. Tim Wood attended the meetings when he was director before his retirement. There is a strong commitment from these two state agencies to see this project through. The county is extremely supportive of it. This is in an active, managed forest. So don't worry, it will still stay an active managed forest. There are trails down the Wilson River right now through an active managed forest, and that's what we'd like to show, is that you can have an active managed forest and still have positive recreation out there at the same time. There's been some fears from some of the hunters that, oh, it's going to be close to hunting. It's not going to be close to hunting. The hunting rules do not change in the Salmon Berry Corridor any different than they've always had. So if you hear any of that, put that to bed. This is a great opportunity, and I may be exaggerating a little bit, but when you think of the Appalachia Trail and how popular it is, well, this is kind of our trail from Portland to the coast, that people can bike and come over and recreate on the coast or go hiking, and we'd like them to stay in Tillamook County for a while. But it has a potential great opportunity. It's an expensive project. It's a multi-year, if not a multi-decade project. It's going to be done in segments. It's not going to be done all at once. But we need legislative support for this effort in order to move it forward. There's this small group right now is kind of moving on our own to try to push the project forward, and I know Tillamook County is going to be financially committed to this project. We've already talked to some grantors, some nonprofits that might be willing to fund some of this project. In fact, we've already got a grant request in for some ODOT funds from Garibaldi up to what they call Barview Park to pave a portion of the trail that's already there now. So from a water line that's built. Really positive project, and it's got a great opportunity, and it's got a great opportunity for the future. So I hope that that you're as excited about it, you will get as excited about it as a number of us are. So it's a great project.
So any questions for our testimony? I want to thank both of you for being here for both of these, and again, this is another one of those committee bills, so we'll be looking at the end of the session, into today, to support a movement to send these on to the session. So,
thank you for your courtesy and letting us go first.
Thank you. Yep. We're going to leave this one in recess while we move back to the order of the original order. So we're going to open a public hearing on the Elliott State Forest land sales. And Richard Whitman, appreciate you coming and spending some time with us.
You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Richard Whitman. I'm Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor. Pleased to be here this morning to talk to you about the Elliott State Forest. Let me give you a little bit of an overview. I think some of you are very familiar with the Elliott State Forest, but just to set the context a little bit, the Elliott State Forest is about 90,000 acres of land owned by the state, primarily in Coos County, a little bit in Douglas County. The land is an asset of the State Common School Fund, which funds our K through 12 schools. It's managed by the Oregon Department of Forestry for the Land Board. The Common School Fund is derived from lands that were given to the state of Oregon at statehood by the federal government. These are the school lands that are common throughout the West. And the Elliott is really sort of the jewel, remaining jewel of the Common School Fund lands in the state of Oregon. Since 1955, the Elliott State Forest has generated more than $300 million for K through 12 schools in Oregon. It generates a substantial majority of the revenue from lands, the land assets in the Common School Fund. The Elliott State Forest is also a jewel in ecological terms. It contains some of the older timber on the coast and some of the watersheds that are in the best shape on the coast of Oregon as well. You're all aware that starting back in the early 90s and continuing on to today, we've had listings of a number of species under the Federal Endangered Species Act, starting with the northern spotted owl, of course, but more recently with marbled murrelet. These listings have had an effect on harvest levels in the Elliott State Forest, particularly within the last couple of years, and particularly as a result of the marbled murrelet-ish listing. The science on murrelets is still relatively undeveloped in terms of exactly what habitat is necessary to sustain the bird over the long term. They're also a species that's distributed fairly widely across the landscape. And the result of that, with the northern spotted owl, the sites that need to be protected for the owl are relatively discrete. And both the state and other land managers have been able, there have obviously been reductions in harvest, but it's an easier species to manage around than the murrelet. The murrelet is more widely dispersed, there's less certainty about the habitat that's required. So as a result, it is starting to have more and more of an effect on forest management on the Oregon coast. It also is particularly dependent on some of the older timber, which exists in the Elliott State Forest in particular. The state of Oregon had a habitat conservation plan in place from the federal government for owls for a number of years that has expired, that gave the state protection from any regulatory problems in terms of the northern spotted owl. For a number of years, the state attempted to negotiate a habitat conservation plan with the federal government for both owls and murrelets and, frankly, other species as well. That effort was not successful and was ended several years ago, and the State Land Board, which is the ultimately responsible for the Elliott, adopted a new management plan for the Elliott that was really based on a technique called survey and manage, which involves going out and surveying for these species and then managing to avoid them, avoid take of them in terms of harvest operations. There was litigation filed against the state in 2012. By Cascadia Wildland Center for Biological Diversity in Portland Audubon, that resulted in a court injunction halting some sales on the Elliott because of risk of take of marbled murrelets. We've been in settlement discussions with the plaintiffs in that litigation for some time and actually are very close to settlement of that litigation. But the end result of that litigation is fairly significant change in management on the Elliott State Forest that has resulted this past year and likely will continue to result in significant reductions in harvest from around a level of about 40 million board feet down to a level of about 4.5 million board feet per year this past year. So a reduction of, you know, almost 90% in harvest levels. The dollar result of that is we've gone from generating roughly $7 to $10 million a year in revenue to a loss in this past year, where the state actually lost about $3 million in terms of management of the Elliott State Forest. The these are common school fund lands. They are both under the Federal Admissions Act and our Oregon Constitution. They have to be managed to maximize long-term revenue to the schools. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we have really competing desires in terms of land management, the desire to conserve what is good, important habitat and really some special habitat on the coast, and also our obligation to the state school system to generate revenue. So what to do? The land board began a process about 6 months ago to start to look at other options for the Elliott. And in December of 2013, the land board voted unanimously to go ahead with a sale of three parcels in the Elliott, about 3,000 acres out of the 90,000 acres, so just over 3% of the land base, really for the purpose of determining what the value of those lands are, what the value is in terms of timber management, and also what the value is in terms to conservation buyers as well. So those sales obviously have generated a robust public input into that process with the land board, which is great. We had some good testimony before the land board in December. And but the land board is going ahead with those sales for the purpose of really determining What are the values and what are the long-term options for management of those lands? All the options for the Elliott are on the table. We are continuing to talk with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries about a habitat conservation plan for some or all of the Elliott. We also, are looking at the option of sale of the Elliott if necessary, or basically all things in between. I think this is going to be a process that takes a couple of years at least to sort through and figure out what the best long-term options are for the Elliott. One other piece of that, which I'll just mention, is I mentioned that the science on murrelets is relatively new and frankly undeveloped. So another thing that is going on is a review of the current science on murrelets. There was some money appropriated in the long session for that purpose, and that also will inform this process of what the long-term options are for the Elliott. In the long term, the land board is going to have to come to a resolution that is consistent with the Admissions Act and the Oregon Constitution in terms of maximizing revenue to the common schools. Exactly what that means right now, we don't know, but the actions that the land board has just taken start us down a path toward figuring that out. This is an asset that's important to a wide range of people on the coast, not only for its conservation values, but the Elliott also is a principal source of some of the older timber for many of the mills in that part of the state. So the economic value of the Elliott is not just its immediate employment value in terms of management, it's also a key part of the forest economy in that part of the state as well. And we recognize that and are working closely with both public and private land management partners as we look toward what the long-term options are for this very important asset of the state. With that, that's my testimony for this morning. I'd be very happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Yes, Senator Berger.
You know, it's troubling to hear this scenario. If we go back 25 years ago with the spotted owl situation, we had a theory that the spotted owl may be endangered, and we basically shut down the federal timberlands, devastated communities, displaced families, and we have counties now that are just plagued with unemployment and no law enforcement. And now we come to find out that it probably wasn't as much to do with timber harvest as it was to do with another species taking over, mm-hmm. natural selection process. And now we did all of this because of a theory. And now you just tell me again that we really don't know what's going on with the marble murrelet. We really don't have the science. We don't have the data. But yet we're ready to shut everything down again. And I think that's really troubling. And I don't really think we realize in this building what this does to Oregonians. You know, I had some conversations with some people that worked at the mills all their lives. They're in their late 50s. Their house isn't paid for. Their kids aren't out of college. They really aren't ready to retire. But the mill disappears. And what's that person supposed to do? And that there's no other employment in that area. And I think we got to start remembering the carnage that goes along when we start speculating on these. Now, I will be the first person to stand up and help protect a species, but I want the science. I want to know what we're doing, and I will get behind that. But I'm not prepared to devastate communities on theories and speculations anymore.
Comment?
Chair Roblin, Senator Bartschiger, we share your frustration on the science on this. I won't comment on the northern spotted owl and all the work that's being done to try to turn that situation around. But with regard to murrelets, there's a high level of frustration with the federal services for not being a little bit more proactive in terms of taking a position on what the science is. We have a group called the Pacific Seabird group, which has essentially established what the scientists say is the best available science on murrelets. But as I said, we have a lot of we share your concerns that the science is very undeveloped on this. And unfortunately, we have a federal court that has ordered the state to change its management. So we're really put in a position where we have no choice, and we're managing through that as best we can, including looking at the science. But getting to a point where we know what the science on murrelets is likely to be a process that takes 10 to 15 years. So what happens in the meantime? What happens to the mills? What happens to the workers? That's the difficult situation that we're in. That's why we are looking seriously at a variety of options for how to maximize revenue, which is the ultimate objective of the land board here, which translates into jobs and income for mills. But we share your frustration on the science.
Follow up here.
Thank you. You know, selling the Elliott Forest may sound like a good idea, but who's going to buy it if people are going to say they're going to constantly bring up lawsuits that you can't log it from the? So I don't know what kind of value will be there. I mean, being in this business, I'd be a little bit weary. what's the old saying in real estate? Buyer beware. I think this would be a real big buyer beware. So that, we're in a difficult situation. You're right, and I think. The only way to make good progress is to show some solidarity in the state of Oregon and go to the federal government. And I really believe that's probably the only way we're going to really see some progress.
Thank you.
I just want to make a couple comments. One is that, you know, the Elliott Forest, in my opinion, should be the poster child for correct management. The state forestry has done an amazing job, and if you look back 30 years ago, they were harvesting probably 80 million board feet. I can't remember exactly what the top number got to be, but it was in those numbers. And everybody continues to say who spends time there that this is an amazing forest. I mean, it really is. They didn't cut all of the old growth in any of their harvest practices. They kind of stayed away as much as they could from real steep slopes. I think earlier on they did a little bit more of that than they have lately. Then they went into about 40 million, and then the lawsuits happened and it got down to 10 and 15 different years. It got to be hard to manage. But the reason it's in such great shape is it was a managed forest. I mean, it doesn't look like federal forests. It looks like a place people would think of as a great forest.
Right.
And that meant clear cutting in different areas and making. I mean, the other thing that was really great for our area is that it has been an amazing hunting area,
mm-hmm.
because there have been areas of meadows where deer and antelope and, I mean, deer and your elk can graze, and wildlife has a place in that forest.
Yeah.
And I am concerned that if these lawsuits keep happening, they will become like federal forests where everything in it is dead. I mean, you don't have elk in the big old forests any longer. They can't live there. They can't get through it. So they live on the peripheries. They go into farmland, and we start having the interaction between our farm community getting all of their food, all of their stuff eaten or trampled by elk and deer and whatever, because that's the only place they can eat. And I think people don't understand that there's a corresponding need for space in this forest, and that if you don't have major forest fires, you've got to have clear cuts or other kinds of things. And I think the other thing that the forests, we've done really well in the Elliott, I mean, with respect to spray, other kinds of stuff, we've been very, very sensitive to how to go about doing things. We've also replanted in ways that other commercial forests don't do, with multiple species, including, you know, the cedar and other kinds of stuff that's going to take a little longer to grow. So I think the land board has done a great job over these years. I wish this lawsuit hadn't happened, but it did. And from my perspective, I am proud of the land board for taking the action to try to figure out what they can do, because they do have a constitutional requirement to maximize the value of that land for the common school fund. And we don't hear about that a lot, but that's their job. And it has produced a lot of timber for a lot of mills in our area. And that's my biggest concern. If the private industry decides that it's worth an investment worth taking, and they outbid environmental groups, they will harvest, but they will own it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it won't go to the private little mills and all those others who have had a chance in the past to buy one little timber sale to keep their mill going. And I really worry about the infrastructure that we have. So I commend the land board for taking the action. I appreciate you coming here to make sure we get this information out to people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's the best solution, but I don't know of another solution that stands there available for you guys to and the land board to do. So I just personally want to thank you. I want to thank you for coming here and sure. being open and letting people understand why it's happening. We have a lot of conversations in our area. Mm-hmm. People who live on the fringe of the Elliott have always loved the Elliott. They didn't particularly like it when they came by and logged the area across the street from them. But as soon as it started growing back, they were happy for the next 50 years. You know, so I mean, it's kind of like they've come to grow and understand a working forest and how to work with it. And the last number of years, it's been disastrous for our communities, and the poverty level continues to grow. And I don't know the answer to the solution or the solution to this, but I think this is the only solution that was available, and I'm happy that they took a really tough vote on the land farm perspective.
Thank you. Well, Chair Robon, the Elliott really should be a model for the entire coast, and we're going to do everything we can to keep it that way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming here and spending some time with us and letting us know. So we're going to close our public hearing on the Elliott State Forest. We've already done LC 156, so we're going to open a public hearing on the Youth Employment Act. And Senator Betsy Close, do you want to go up front, or however you want to be?
I'll go to the dais.
Okay, we'll handle that. Thanks.
Happy New Year to you.
And back to you.
You want to wait?
We can pull another chair up.
They seem to be locked together.
No, they pull up and they can come. There you go. Shelley is always prepared. So thank you, Senator Close, for being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Roblin, and Co-Chair Bearchigger, and members of the committee, which is, I am one, for this opportunity to present.
Be identify yourself.
I'm Senator Betsy Close.
Thank you.
To present this 2014 Youth Employment Act to you today. Increasingly, our young people who are seeking to enter the workforce are facing obstacles to getting hired. Companies have become more and more specific in the skills they want an applicant to have. For example, I recently heard of a young man right out of college with a finance degree who applied for a foundry job in the metals industry in quality control. Applicants were asked by email to graph a statistic manipulation problem regarding metal temperatures using Excel. They were to produce a graph and a table as well as a summary within 24 hours, emailing it to the corporation just to receive an interview. Although this job did not require a college degree, the young man who got the job got it because he had college-level courses in business statistics and technical writing. When I saw what Linn County is doing to help young workers gain these type of skills on a first job, I was very encouraged that we in government could work together with businesses and help our youth receive the crucial on-the-job skills that they need to succeed in their careers. So we're calling this the huge, well, it's called a huge wage, youth wage agreement. Linn County has been doing this. I want to congratulate Linn County for this very innovative alliance with local businesses because they form contracts with them for a specified amount of time, I believe. So Commissioner Roger Nyquist is here today, Albany Chamber Director Janet Steele, and I'll let them explain it to you further.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Close, Mr. Chairman, Senators. We started this program back in 2006. For the record, Roger Nyquist,
thank you,
Chair of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. We started this program back in 2006, targeted mostly towards ag. When I was a young boy growing up in Lynn County, there was a farmer who taught me how to work, move an irrigation pipe. And it was a lot of work for me, but probably the first week was a lot of work for him, too. And in talking to farmers, the feedback I got was $8 an hour is a lot of money to pay for the privilege of teaching somebody's kid how to work. And being the facilitator that I am, I said, well, what would you pay them? What if it was $6 an hour? And that perked their interest. And so we went back and carved out part of the lottery dollars we receive as a county for the program, created a one-page form. Because the other thing about small business owners is generally they don't wake up in the morning looking to interact with government. And so we had to make it as simple as possible. You have the form before you. And so it's been working fairly well since 2006. Hundreds of kids have gotten the opportunity to work, to learn real job skills in the workplace that they likely otherwise would not have gotten. As the economy ebbs and flows, we see a decrease or an increase in participation based on that. Recently, it's been tough to get anybody to talk about hiring kids at any level. But we think the real job experience at high school age is an important component of workforce development, and it's just worked very well for us.
We'll hear from all three and then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, honored senators, my name is Janet Steele. I'm president of the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce, and it's a position that I've held for almost 20 years with the chamber. Over that time, I've seen the number of youth that are now being hired in our communities and in Lynn County decrease in a large way, in part because of the economic downturn that we had, but in great part because of the restrictions that are now required by employers, that they are unable to hire certain ages of kids anymore. Regarding those lines, then you have high unemployment with our youth, and then you have high unemployment with college kids. I mean, the recent economic downturn, you've had adults now taking positions that are, and you probably all know that, adults taking positions from our kids. One way to incentivize businesses to give these kids the 16 to 19-year-old jobs is to incentivize them with the $2 assistance that Lynn County has given. It offers an opportunity for these kids to get their first job and learn about work-life skills, the skill sets necessary to continue on in a job. It gives them an opportunity to gain experience in particular positions that they may or may not want to continue into as they go about, and then develop the work ethic. We have a workforce development task force in our community that's been working with industries and business leaders for quite some time. And one of the largest needs that an employer has for a first-time employee is, do they have the work ethic? Can they show up on time? Do they understand what it takes to work with others? You know, all those things that people of my generation take for granted that we know, our kids, without having these first jobs at a young age, are finding it extremely difficult to learn and put into practice then when eventually they do get a job. I have, our chamber does what's called a youth job fair, and we take, every December, we take 1,500 high school seniors in a one-day, for one day out at Lynn Benton Community College, and they interact and interview with over 200 volunteers. I've done this for a number of years, and I can tell you that there's a huge frustration at that high school senior age, that from both employers and students, that they haven't had a job yet. the students are out there looking for a job, and they're finding it difficult to get that experience because college and young adults are taking those positions. The employer is frustrated that it's hard to hire a high school student because they don't have the experience in that very first small job. And so it's a continuing cycle that is growing. And I think what the Linn County Youth Wage Grant has done is offered, as Roger said, hundreds of kids the opportunity to get that firsthand experience in a small business, to develop that work ethic, to understand what those employers are looking for, to get a firsthand look at what the skill sets are in those jobs. And those opportunities may not have come about without that $2 an hour assistance that helped that small employer employ somebody. And it's a summertime position. I'm not sure what Senator Close's bill is going to say on that yet, but it really is a valuable and in our case almost a necessary assistance to small businesses to give them that final push to say, okay, I'm going to give this kid a chance. I've got some help in order to do that. And it's giving those kids some experiences that they would never get until they're out of school or continuing education, because those opportunities aren't there in this economy.
Questions? I guess what I would say is that what's the age limit for
14 to it was 14 to 19 mostly. It's the vast majority is high school kids,
right?
Okay,
but the goal, the parameters are 14 to 19.
And then the other bully conditions, no power equipment, all that kind of stuff, still applies. They
right.
They have to use them in particular places so that they
correct.
Okay,
correct. And in many cases, the small business owner is more familiar with bully requirements after this program than when it started, because we make them be aware and adhere to those.
Okay. Yes. Senator Barsugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really applaud you guys for doing this. A real short story is that's probably how I got to where I am today. I started when I was 13 in a corporation. We had some family ties. It was an international corporation. And I worked a few nights a week cleaning floors and cleaning bathrooms. And by the time I was in high school, I was actually working a few hours every day at that corporation. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was working the whole summer. And as much as I really wanted to work without letting my schooling go. Now, there was no doubt that I was being groomed to move up the ladder in that corporation pretty fast, but I chose a different path when I graduated and came to Oregon and went to work in the woods. But if it wasn't, you're absolutely right. At that young age, I learned work ethics, responsibility, and yeah, it was only $1.52 an hour, mm-hmm. and you went and worked for 2 hours, so you had your $3, but the money was not the gift. The gift was the experience and the responsibility. And I believe that was a real good foundation of how I lived the rest of my life. So I really applaud your program. I think it's great.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I have to concur that for me, figuring out how to get, as a high school principal, getting kids out in an environment where the people are very honest with them about what the expectations are. Which is difficult, more difficult in schools to do than it used to be. And, you know, my dad was a vocational carpenter, worked as a foreman in a cabinet shop. And I went to work there fairly early as the cleanup kid, getting my little bit of money. But then he wanted me to see other vocations. So there was a sheet metal company, and he told the sheet metal guy he wanted me to go to college. And so I was the guy that went underneath the old house and drug the pipes to put the new system in and realized, I don't know if I want to do this metal. You know, but it also let me get the job to go to college at the mill, because I had experience in work experience with some people that other people knew and trusted their opinions, and it did teach those work ethic, how to prepare yourself to be there and do the things. You don't talk back to the guy that's paying you. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that you learn fairly quickly if you're going to survive in this world that we don't let our kids don't have the opportunity to do as often anymore. And so unless there's a family business, that still allows some. But I think the idea is there. How much do you spend annually? How much do you set aside for the program? And does it get used?
We budget $50,000. We've not ever used that much. It generally is in the $20,000 to $30,000 range. My one, if we could execute better, would be to employ more kids. We had a period of time where the state employment office was sending letters out to every small business, every eligible employer in the county. That seemed to help through their budget issues. They've not been able to do that the last two or three years. So what we get is we get an article in the newspaper in the spring when this starts. The chamber usually just sends out a little email, and we've not more aggressively marketed this program than that at this point.
Have the schools have work experience programs usually, and they get kids out. Do they know about the system, and are they trying to encourage it so that people understand, you know, you can do some different things for us to give experiences to kids if you're willing?
They have on some limited basis, and, okay. And what's happened is a few of those kids, pretty sharp, they take the form and they go into the employer and they become the recruiter for the program.
Right, that's good.
You can hire me for $2 an hour less than anybody here who's going to apply, because I want to introduce you to this program. So,
have you gotten any pushback from that particular thing? Jobs going away from adults and others who...
I certainly have heard of none.
Okay. Zero. None. Okay. Senator
Bitcher. One thing that you may consider to streamline or to expand this program, I think one of the hurdles that you'll find with, like, the farmers and stuff is payroll. Okay, so if you have no employees and you're not set up for payroll and all of that other stuff that comes with it, which is a lot, you know, you think to yourself, well, I'd like to hire somebody, but I don't want to go down this paperwork nightmare trail. So if there's some way that you could set up or work with a temporary organization, you know, a temp employment, so the farmer can just pay them and they can handle all that, because, you know, the average guy that has no employee probably does not want to enter the realm of all the stuff that goes along with having an employee. Yeah.
Okay. Again, thank you very much for the presentation. And for our committee to understand, the committee to understand, this is a priority bill for Senator Close. Mm-hmm. So it is not one that we'll be taking action on. She'll decide whether and how she wants to do that next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll close our public hearing on the Youth Employment Act, and we're going to come back to the recess that we'd taken on the Salmonberry Trail. So that was still open, basically. So, and with that, Doug Decker and whoever else you want, Doug, you've already heard the glowing reports from a couple other people. So.
Indeed.
And thank you for being here.
Yes, it is. Thank you for the invitation. Good morning. We have some slides that we're going to put up here in a moment. First, to start out, good morning, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bertschiger, Senator Prezansky, Senator Close, Beth. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm the Oregon State Forester, the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined here this morning by my friend and colleague John Potter, the Assistant Director at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Before I start in on the Salmonberry, I just wanted to follow up on two items. First, it's a little unusual to be here visiting with you and not talking about fire. I just wanted to recognize that.
We didn't have very many, did we?
We had a few. We'll be talking more about that during the short session, I know.
Yeah.
I also wanted to voice and share the committee's frustration and the governor's office frustration relative to the Elliott, and remind that the Coast Range remains probably the best place on the continent to grow trees, and also to recognize that the state has a unique role and a unique set of land management objectives, different than federal lands, different than private lands as well. And so I felt it would be unusual to sit here and not recognize that. It's a huge issue for us. So
This morning, John and I are going to, at your request, going to give you a little brief introduction, although Senator Johnson and Commissioner Labhart have done a great job. But we're going to show you some pictures and kind of put you on the map a little bit about the project. And really a project that we are collaborating on as a result of a local request for our assistance related to this multi-use trail that would follow the path of the former Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad. I'll provide some background on the project, how it came to be, a little bit of context about the history, the resource, the geography. We'll talk about the call to action from the local players to date. John's going to cover kind of the vision for the project and the planning work that's underway right now, then I'll come back and close with a short discussion about the legislative concept and what it would do for us. So let's go on a little bit here. First, I'd say that our two agencies are here and we're engaged in this work because we answered the call from Mark Labhart and the commission, the Tillamook County Commission, as well as the Port of Tillamook Bay commissioners, who expressed an interest in making the best of a challenging situation. That's the way I would describe it. They wanted to make the best use of a significant infrastructure and investment that has been made over time, been built up actually over more than 100 years, and that is going to slowly deteriorate without intervention. We're here, ODF is here, the Department of Forestry. We're here because of the geography, and I'll describe in a moment, involves a transit through the Tillamook State Forest, which we own and manage. And also, we have a distinct interest in helping the public understand the role of active forest management, and this is a natural connection there. State Parks is here, I believe, because it's the state's lead agency for recreation planning and for development. So, but we wouldn't be here without the local call to action, and so with support from the local legislators and the port officials and the county commissioners and the communities, we've been Tim Wood and John and others in the state parks team and myself have been supporting a collaborative effort to assess what the possibilities are, to do the homework and to listen to the needs and the ideas from around the area, and then develop an approach going forward. So just for context, here's the map. You heard earlier the Salmonberry. I think the shorthand, the Salmonberry, has been used as shorthand to refer to the former Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad. It runs 82 miles over the top of the Oregon Coast Range, right through the Tillamook State Forest, between Tillamook and Banks. It bridges the coast and the metro area as it cuts across Tillamook and Washington counties. And here you can see the basic geography and the beginnings of some of the planning work that we've been engaged in to identify specific trail segments which have a distinct different feel about each segment. There is the Coast Range, the coast. There's along the Nehalem River. There is the Salmonberry piece, and that's the piece that has been most significantly affected by this damage. And then there's the Valley Link over on the east side as the line lowers into the metro area. The line was built originally in 1911 by the Pacific Railway and Navigation Company, or the PRN. It was the first major connection by land between Tillamook Bay and the Portland area. It kind of revolutionized commerce between the Portland area and Tillamook Bay. Prior to that, it had been by sea. It did carry freight. It carried passengers, tourists by the thousands. And because it was built in such a remote and rugged terrain, it received the nickname Punk Rotten and Nasty, PRNN, Punk Rotten and Nasty is what it was called. Constructing the line, as you can see in some of these pictures here, it just required a near miraculous focus of engineering and sheer strength and guts and really a leap of faith to transit this remote and unforgiving route. And it took the same to keep it open over those last 100 years through significant forest fires, through floods, through landslides and collapses and all manner of hazards. The historic flooding and storms in 2007 devastated portions of the line, and here you can see a few pieces where there's just no there anymore. You can see in that the background picture the rail line running across the top there. Significant damage. The overwhelming costs of re-engineering and reconstruction led the Port of Tillamook Bay Commission to consider other options for the devastated portions and to lease intact portions for active trail use, which I don't show here. The Oregon Coast Scenic Railroad, a nonprofit organization, is actively and very successfully
utilizing existing pieces of the track for tourist trains, and that's working really well. Those trains are booked, so they remain in active use. But there are significant stretches that are isolated, including a number of major tunnels and trestles that are in the Salmonberry River portion of Tillamook County. Both John and I have hiked down through much of that area, and I can tell you that Mother Nature reclaims that country very quickly. And there are a dozen or more trestles. There are 20 or so tunnels, and in some cases, some places, it's actually difficult to see the tracks. Just even in these 7 short years since the rail has not been maintained. After the port determined the restoration of the rail was not immediately feasible, the Port Commission and the county, joined by Senator Johnson and the chairs of our boards, my board forestry chair Blackwell at the time, and Commissioner Moriucci from the Parks and Recreation Commission, asked Tim and I to join them in thinking about the future of the route. And that conversation really began in 2011. And we had a series of meetings, which Mark referenced earlier. We discussed this, the notion of a coalition of supporters, and that began to grow quickly. We held some organizing meetings in Tillamook County and attracted the attention and the participation of groups like the Oregon Coast Scenic Railroad, Cycle Oregon, and others. The small leadership group of the port and the county and our two agencies proposed a simple starting out governance structure and a framework that involved reaching out through a series of community meetings, which we had indicated here, and some listening posts, and really doing an early feasibility study, which we completed in 2012. As interest developed, Cycle Oregon actually donated $100,000 to help the master planning effort that's underway right now, that John's going to touch on here in a minute. Along the way, we've built quite a coalition of interest, and we refer to this as the Salmonberry Coalition Partners. John and I will be co-chairing that meeting on Friday, this coming Friday in Wheeler. We meet about quarterly to provide updates. Here's a partial list. It's been amazing and satisfying to see the level of interest and support and the flow of good ideas that has come from the group. And we'll be meeting with the group again on Friday to talk to them a little bit about the legislative concept and to continue to listen and respond to their ideas and concerns. So John's going to take it from here and cover the shared vision that's emerged and the planning that's underway, and then we'll come back and touch on the legislative concept. John?
Thanks, Doug. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Potter. I'm the Assistant Director at State Parks, and I'm here today to talk to you about this truly special and iconic opportunity for establishing a place in Tillamook County, the Salmonberry Trail. Doug's discussed the strong coalition of partners that's been building around this project, and I want to emphasize that this includes both people who see the enormous opportunity as well as those who may still have some reservations. And that's fine, because we're working towards a shared vision on this project. There are many interests along the trail, and there will be concerns. And we've heard from adjacent landowners and hunters and loggers and dairy farmers, and we've heard from the rail operators and other groups that are concerned about the deterioration of the current line. But the partnership is committed to work through concerns in a way that meets the public interest as well as addressing the specific concerns that people have. So I'll talk about the public interest side for a minute. And as Doug pointed out, it was about 100 years ago that the Tillamook line was completed and opened for business. And it took Tillamook from seeming like it was 1,000 miles away from Portland to being truly and closely connected through the Salmonberry Corridor. While the rail was primarily for wood and dairy and the products coming from Tillamook County, it was also a recreational corridor, even in 1911. I read an Oregonian article from 1910 asking the question whether Portlanders would continue to go to Long Beach and Washington resorts, or whether with the opening of this line, they would now go to Nehalem and our own coast, which they did. Mm-hmm. 100 years ago, also, one of the most famous recreational corridors in the country was proclaimed to be in the public interest by the Oregon legislature and Governor Oz West, and that was the Beach Highway Bill. So we're here to ask, does our generation have the opportunity to look 100 years ahead and make our own contribution to making our state a great and special place? What if you took the existing grades and bridges and tunnels and trestles and saved them and reused them to reestablish a special sort of recreational connection between the coast and the city? there is salvageable value yet, but it won't last forever. So turning an overgrown, deteriorating line like is shown here on the Port of Tillamook Bay line near Buxton into something like the Banks Vernonia Trail, also right nearby. This is sort of where the trail splits and goes up towards Vernonia on the Banks Vernonia line, and here heads west up through the forest. So I think we'll go on to the next slide.
Sure.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about individuals and communities in terms of the public benefit. Statewide recreational use surveys that have been done for the past several statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plans, the SCORPs, have consistently identified soft surface walking trails as well as off-street bicycle trails as being the top priority that people want statewide. That's what they're asking for in terms of recreational need, recreational value. They want them for enjoyment, they want them for their families, and they want them for their health and opportunities at education. So turning the Salmon Berries Camp Creek Trestle, which is shown here in this slide, into something like the Buxton Trestle on the Banks Vernonia Trail would give people not only a fun place to visit, but also a place to reduce stress, improve their physical fitness and physical health. Transformations like these also draw people to rural areas in a managed way. Like this past Monday, I happened to be going by on the Banks Vernonia Trail, and I swung past the Manning Trailhead. 11 o'clock in January on a Monday, completely full. There were 7 or 8 cars there, people taking bikes off the top of their car, people walking their dogs and enjoying that part of Western Washington County. I drove on to Banks and the trailhead that we built in Banks several years ago. Also, about seven cars in there, right next to the Banks bicycle shop, which wasn't in existence before this trail was completed and fully paved, where you can rent a bike for half a day for $28 and ride up to Vernonia and have lunch at the Blue House Cafe or the Black Bear Coffee Company. And those places have a contribution from these visitors, and it helps support their business. So right now there's over 200,000 visits to this Banks Vernonia Trail every year, and that's growing. That continues to grow every year. And so it's our conclusion that the Banks Vernonia Trail has had a significant impact, and one that something like the Salmon Berry Trail could have similarly. We've asked state park visitors to this area, sort of how much do they bring to the economy. We've asked them, what do you spend when you come visit a state park? And those traveling within 30 miles of the state park, they spend on average $44 during their trip when they go to visit the state park. Those that were able to draw from a further distance out, from over 30 miles, they spend more like $76 on average when they go on restaurants, on picking blueberries, on bike rentals, and everything else associated with the recreational experience. So if, conservatively, the Salmon Berry destination drew 200,000 visitors, and I think it could draw significantly more than that ultimately, that's another $3 to $4 million of spending annually in Tillamook and Western Washington County. And while that doesn't solve anything for anybody, it helps diversify the economy. It helps add additional opportunities for people to interact in that local economy. Next slide. So how might this happen? We've sort of looked at an approach with three broad phases. One is the planning, which is going on right now, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But then also the fundraising and the project delivery. While good planning is essential, fundraising is likely to be the key to this project. And any project of this magnitude would have to be and should be funded by a combination of both public and private sources. That means private donations, grants from a number of different sources, as well as public support, investing together to create something that's well-loved and well-used and is a recreation driver in this area. So we're in the middle of planning right now, and we have a goal of determining the overall feasibility for this project. We also have a goal of developing an idea of the scope and the cost, what exactly is feasible, could happen here, and maybe what are some of the initial projects that could be created to generate immediate use and connection with this trail. And then another goal of the master planning is seeing if there's support or not. Maybe there's support for this project, maybe there's not. That needs to still be evaluated fully. Public input is happening throughout this project, but particularly in the next 6 months. So during the assessments, opportunities, and constraints evaluation and into the development of alternatives, which is hoped to be concluded by July of this year. Planning will produce a draft plan and an ultimate final plan for adoption for agreement among the partners by the end of the year in 2014. So I've talked about what a shared vision might look like. I've given you a sense of the planning work that's underway, and I've given you some idea of the time frame and the critical path. Now, Doug's going to speak to the elements of the possible legislation around this.
Right. Okay. Thanks, John. Briefly, I think collectively, based on the interest that we've had from others who you've heard from today and local communities and the requests that we received from the county and the port, our agencies felt that a need to establish some baseline authority to embark on the work, which is embodied in LC 152. I have personal experience with ODF on several significant regional projects like this, and I know that it is very helpful and essential to really to start the work based on a solid footing in the form of legislative authority, and LC 152 does that. To be effective, the work is going to have to be carried out over multiple planning cycles, multiple budget cycles, multiple administrations perhaps, and legislative terms. And so having a clear intent and focus on the work sends a message to the future that this is a project that we know is going to take time and that it has strong local support, which you heard from today, and will take some sustained effort from multiple partners. So the bill does that. So first and foremost, what it does is it directs our agencies to work together, which we're doing, with local jurisdictions and private partners to develop this plan that looks at existing uses, the costs, the benefits, and the development strategies. That's first. Second, it calls us to develop a wide array of funding sources. I think this is critical, as John has said, particularly including private and non-government sources. We know the Cycle Oregon has stepped up with a very significant planning grant to get this started. And then it also creates a fund to receive and hold outside monies. Third, it requires us, working with all of our partners and stakeholders, to do the homework on the approaches for operating and maintaining a trail, not just a plan, but what's it going to take to, what would it take to sustain this type of operation? What are the needs and the costs, whether it be fire or, emergency services? You know, those are things that that we need to think through. And lastly, it asks us to bring back a package to you for your consideration in the fall of 2015. So that's essentially the components of the LC that's before you. I wanted to just close with this picture. This kind of conveys the magnitude of the damage. This is 20 feet off the ground, a railroad rail going through the middle of the two Douglas fir trees. Also, there is a sense of opportunity that's before us. I think there are examples of completed projects like this, the BV Trail, as John's mentioned, in Oregon and around the West, that really indicate the potential for success here. And I think we're excited about this idea of relinking communities along the existing rail corridor, converting the no longer functioning portions of rail to a trail, adding a trail segment to those viable sections of where rail exists today, and really create the first ever rails and trails linkage between the metro area and the Oregon coast. We think it can become a national regional attraction, provide new opportunities, and again, from our standpoint, help us tell the story of the management of these important lands. So we'll park it there. Glad to take your questions, comments.
Any questions? Senator Batchick.
Who owns the line currently?
Chair Roblin, Senator Birchiger, the line is currently owned by the Port of Tillamook Bay. There's a variety of different ownership mechanisms. There's some that are where they actually own the right of way outright. There are easements. There are some private inholdings. The state essentially owns the uplands from 40 feet of center, but essentially it is a Port of Tillamook Bay asset at this point.
Okay. And follow up.
Yep.
Thank you. That picture of that slide and the span,
yes,
and everything, did Mother Nature had a fill removal permit before she did that?
Senator Birchiger, there was a significant number of other permits that would have been required, and no, I don't believe so.
Yes, Senator, close.
Thank you. It's certainly a beautiful area, especially when the sun is shining.
Mm-hmm.
However, we know the amount of rain that comes down out there. Have you thought about how hard it's going to be to maintain the trail? Because I assume if the rail went down with metal, all that metal reinforcement, the trails will also. Do you have a management plan for that?
Chair Roblin, Senator Close, I think that is a central question. I think it's likely that there will be pieces, based on the work that's underway right now, there will be pieces of the trail that won't go back where the rails were. I mean, you saw in those pictures, some of those areas are unbuildable, undefendable. And I think, you know, the history teaches us over the last 100 years, maintaining this line was a huge task by the port, by Southern Pacific that owned it before that, and then PRNN. I think we need to make some careful strategic choices about places where the trail goes and places where it doesn't go, with the idea of getting ourselves into a situation that's going to require the repeated investment. These are, you know, unpredictable forces, and when the water is moving like it did in 2007, you don't want to have any type of infrastructure and investment in the way.
Follow-up?
Yes.
And also, considering the port, in my district, we're having more and more complaints about people that are trying to ship up to Tacoma and the transportation problems and, you know, the congestion. Does the port have, if they lose this rail, I don't know how much of it they're using, do they still have adequate transportation to that port?
Right. Chair Roblin, Senator Close, I think, a couple thoughts on that. So I would say that the majority of rail line exists and would continue to exist. There's that 16 miles of chaos that you saw. That's the piece that's out. So, and I believe it's the port's intention here, you know, that they the right of way, you know, there's a formal recognition of a rail corridor. I don't believe that is going away. So I think that there's always a potential that's there. When the port made the choice to find other options, there was a robust discussion about transportation along Highway 6 and along Highway 26, and predominantly relative to, you know, dairy products and wood products. I think the decision at that point was made that there was sufficient transportation options available based on the potential cost of trying to restore this as a active rail corridor. So for me, you know, it's key that I think it's important not to preclude future options. We don't know what our needs are going to be down the road. But I think at this point, I think the port has evaluated it and said that they feel that transportation options do exist.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? I guess, and this one just barely touches my district, actually, at the very, very end of the rail, after it leaves Tillamook City and goes down to the port. And that line they are keeping open to Wheeler. We ought to get the treasurer involved, since it's ancestral part of Oregon.
There is a connection.
But this was always not a narrow gauge line. This was always a full gauge line. Because a lot of the timber lines, actually, from northern Washington, where I came from, they put narrow gauges in, because I was looking at some of the trestle work they had to make. It was cheaper to make a smaller trestle,
yeah,
but that was just for getting timber out of the woods. This one has always been passengers and freight.
That's correct.
As well. That's an interesting line. And like the Coos Bay Rail line, a lot of tunnels and a lot of water crossings, which mm-hmm. make it a really difficult line.
It's a complicated transportation that we're
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exciting ideas, and again, this is one of those that is one of the committee bills that we'll have to consider at the end of the day. So thank you very much for your
thank
time.
Thank you.
Very good interest.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short little break while we get, we got some people coming on phone on the next one, so
okay.
We'll take a short. So we're going to come back into our session today, and the next LC concept. Do you want to stay over there, or do you want to come up to the front?
What are
you
going to?
Yeah, right now is going to be reforestation assistance. So we're going to open a public hearing on LC 164, reforestation assistance. And with that, Senator Bertschinger, and do you want to bring the other people up with you?
I don't know.
Come on up. We'll have Mike come on up and, yep.
Not very good.
And we've got two people on the phone as well. So
who do we have on the phone?
So on the phone we have Phil Adams with Roseburg Resources and Dennis Morgan, Oregon Small Woodland Association. So that's all of the people, Senator.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Roblin Committee. My name's Herman Bertschinger, Oregon State Senator, District 2. So in 2013, we saw
you know, just a terrible fire season, mostly in southern Oregon, with numerous lightning strikes and approximately 104,000 acres of state forest land and nearly 20,000 acres of private forest land. What this bill, the intent of this bill is to accelerate the reforestation on these private forest lands, whether they're belong to companies that have large blocks or small landowners. So it's kind of a two-part thing. The bill needs some work, okay? It seems like a lot of things that come out of LC at times need some work. But so it's two-part. One will be a cost-sharing program for some of the larger landowners, and the other thing will be a grant program for some of the small timber owners. Now, keep in mind that anybody that does any type of salvage, have any salvage from these fires, won't qualify. This is just for basically, we had large tracts of land that were in small reprod production with no salvage value. So this is to try to stimulate and incentivize people to start doing the reforestation. Most of these fires in southern Oregon are going to drain into the Rogue drainage system, and that's going to go on for years and years. So if we don't, the faster we get to work, the faster we get trees on there to stabilize the ground, the better it is in the long run. So again, like I'd say, and I'll turn it over to these folks here, but this is to incentivize and to accelerate the reforestation.
So who is going next? And
I think, for the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm here today to do my Vanna White impression to help just advance the slides for Mr. Phil Adams with Roseburg Resources, and I believe he should be next up.
Okay. So, Phil, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, Phil Adams with Roseburg Forest Products. Chair Roblin, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to share the impacts of a catastrophic wildfire to our company, our community, and our forest. I appreciate the opportunity to join you by phone today. As you'll see, I have a lot of work to do. So if we're queued up, Mike, next slide. This is the worst image to a landowner in a forest protection association.
He didn't. There we go. Okay. He's on track now. Very good.
Okay. The results of an unforecasted dry lightning event following extended hot and dry weather conditions. Next slide. For reference, it's interesting to using the same image but adding ownership lines to identify public, BLM in this case, lands from private. This is the ONC checkerboard lands of alternate ownership between private and BLM. ODF, Oregon Department of Forestry, including the Douglas Forest Protective Association, has responsibility for suppression of fire on both ownerships. But note the difference in timber types, age and size, and interestingly, all 10 of the fire starts in this image are on public lands. Next slide. Many of the fires were suppressed at initial attack thanks to prepared crews and additional resources made available thanks to the passage of the Wildfire Protection Act, House Bill 2050, in this last session. But unfortunately, several burned together, creating the Douglas Complex, eventually consuming over 48,000 acres. For 10 days, the Douglas Complex was the number one national priority fire in the nation. Next slide. As soon as the fire was out and firefighters left, landowners were basically left to pick up the pieces, and we started assessment of damages and preparing our plans for restoration almost immediately. Our plans involved salvage where possible, maintaining road infrastructure, reducing hazard mitigation, and reforestation planning. Next slide. Again, just another picture of the devastation in these firestorm areas of the Douglas Complex fire. Over 26,000 acres of the 48,000 acres were designated as moderate to extreme intensity fires, and you can see the results of that fire intensity in this image. Next slide. I want to show you three images of the types of reforestation challenge that our company is going to be dealing with over the next 3 years. The first is a real obvious condition left in a young timber type, in this case, a five-year-old stand of managed Douglas fir that was involved in the high-intensity fire area. Basically, our young trees were vaporized and left behind is a fairly straightforward reforestation challenge. We'll plant this area as rapidly as we can when seedlings become available and integrate this into our new management plan for that area. Next slide. The second image just shows a remnant of a bit older stand type in our young non-salvageable timber stands. Here's a 15-year-old stand with the remnants of the overstory trees still intact. Again, we'll probably be able to plant directly into this area and plant that when seedlings are available. Next slide. But things start getting a little bit more difficult as our young non-merchantable stands get older. Here's an example of a 25-year-old stand. Before the fire, really a fully stocked, well-managed stand of vigorous trees rapidly growing, doing and accomplishing all of our objectives. But now that they're dead, they're actually a liability to our reforestation efforts. We need to physically clear these trees off the land prior to doing any reforestation efforts. And unfortunately, they're just at that stage in their life where they're large enough to cause a reforestation challenge, but too small to be able to economically harvest. And so we'll be doing this work at significant cost. And it has to happen before we can begin our reforestation process. Next slide. So just the numbers of the 11,000 acres that Roseburg had involved in the fire. This concept is really pertinent because over 75% of our acres, a little over 8,000 acres, were actually in what we call our pre-merchantable condition. Not yet ready for harvest, but they have no salvage value and will need to be replanted as soon as possible to become a healthy working forest again. Next slide. Just reiterating our three-year plan, our plan is to pick up the pieces and reinvest as soon as we can. We want to be repairing our roads. We've already started salvaging and reforestation starting this year is very much in our plans. Pretty much a $6 million private capital investment is what we're planning for at this point. Next slide. outlining our tentative schedule, we're, in terms of our reforestation efforts, we're planning to plant 700 acres this year, and then over the next two successive years, we're trying to generate the funds and secure the seedlings to perform two 3,650-acre planting programs through 2016. Next slide. And just as difficult as it will be for Roseburg operationally and financially, the additional risks from lack of managed adjacent public lands will continue. We're concerned about the lack of salvage and restoration in a lot of the current plan thinking right now. We really see this resulting in adjacency risks to private lands after the fire. Next slide. And so in closing, thank you for your consideration and interest in this important concept. I really appreciate Senator Bershinger's initiation and outreach in developing this idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. On the phone, you have Dennis Morgan. I hope is there. Haven't heard from him yet.
Hi, Dennis. Are you there?
Hi.
Yeah, great. Dennis is the chapter president from Jackson Josephine County, and he'd like to speak to the issue from a small woodlands perspective.
Thank you very much. Go right ahead. And don't forget to announce who you are.
Chair Barshiger and members of the Senate Committee for Rural Communities and Economic Development. As is mentioned, my name is Dennis Morgan. My wife and I own 96 acres of forest land in Jackson County. I'm a member of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and currently the president of the Jackson Josephine County chapter of that organization. And OSWA supports the LC-164 legislation. From a personal standpoint, we've owned our land about 10 years, have invested substantially in fuel reduction activity. We are bordered on two sides by BLM land, so we're feeling very, very similar to Phil in terms of the danger that imposes. Certainly the 2013 fire season was one of the worst in many years, and Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas County, along with other areas, have experienced some fairly heavy private forest losses. Reforesting these destroyed private lands is a huge and expensive undertaking, and I had the misfortune of having my forest burned and destroyed, as many were, it would be a very expensive and difficult thing to do and provide the investment needed to do the reforestation at the level needed. We all know that reforestation and restoration following a fire is important for the public values that the forest provide, as well as the economic contribution that forests make to Oregon's economy. It's both the landowners and the public's best interest to have a rapid reforestation. And landowner assistance for reforestation costs when a catastrophic fire occurs, as outlined in LC-164, would really be good public policy. Historically, there was a reforestation tax credit for lands that could have provided landowner assistance from fire losses, but that law sunsetted in 2011 and was not renewed. I would certainly encourage the committee to support LC-164 and provide needed relief to forest owners. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, question.
Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Close. Phil is gone, right? Phil Adams?
I think, Phil, are you still there?
I'm still on the phone.
Okay. Phil, you talked about the adjacency problems if we don't remove those dead trees, dead and dying. Could you just describe in detail what will happen? I assume it's things like erosion and so forth.
Well, our concern is as you can see in that one picture where I showed the ownership overlay, a lot of the public lands in these areas were large timber types, you know, older timber stands that were part of this severe and extreme fire intensity, and they're basically turned from green and growing down to black and dead. And our experience is if you don't remove that overstory of dead trees, they become snags initially, and then over time they become, as they decompose and break down over time, they add to the fuel loads on the forest floor and become increase the fire risk over time. And we've learned our lesson in the Tillamook and the Oxbow that when we remove these snags, you know, dead trees through salvage, and then we actively manage those lands and through reforestation and tree planting and regenerate a healthy forest, they're more fire resistant and resilient than snag patches and brush fields. And that's our concern. We see that the BLM, well, with their current land use allocations and the guidance and standards that that they are obligated to manage to. We won't see that aggressive salvage and active management restoration plan being developed by the agencies. And that's concerning to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They also pose a real risk, physical risk to people in and around
them. Yeah, and absolutely. The whole piece of physical adjacency safety is much on our minds. I, you know, it's hard for me to imagine putting a crew of guys in on my ground replanting our ground next to standing dead trees, you know, in a windstorm, as an example, and it just scares me to death thinking about the physical safety of our crew and workers as well as the general public over time without active salvage.
Because the federal lands are open oftentimes to hunting and fishing activities, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, especially down in the Douglas Complex area that I'm familiar with and the lands we manage, those are basically open road systems that cross our lands and public lands without a lot of gates. And that public access component is a big part of our risk and worry.
Other questions on the committee? Senator Bearsugar, you had one thing, and I had one after that. Go ahead.
Okay. Phil, I'm back. I also want to draw the attention. You know, Oregonians are always concerned about our forests, the environment, and keeping our ecosystem in pretty good shape. And this bill will accelerate that. I've spent my entire life working in the forest, especially in that neck of the woods, which is getting close to 40 years. And so I've been around logging operations, road building, all the different operations. And the most erosion and the most destruction I've ever seen going into the creeks is after a significant wildfire, because there is absolutely nothing to hold all of that charred soil and ash on the ground. Now, this winter, we're getting away light because we really haven't had any big rains, but that could lead on to something else later on in the season. But in a usual year that we get our 30 inches of rain, yeah, you would just be amazed of what those tributaries and creeks look like for the first two or three seasons after. So this is going to hopefully help accelerate and to stop some of that erosion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and my question, I don't care who answers it, but under the Forest Practices Act that we are now under, if you go out and harvest a forest, you have a number of years until you have to reforest it, correct?
Correct.
Now, with a devastating fire, is there any requirement to replant those lands if you chose not to?
I'd like to comment on that.
Go ahead.
Bill Adams again. There's no statutory requirement to reforest after wildfire in timber types or young timber stands that you've reforested as a result of harvest. So you're absolutely right. There's no statutory requirement. But we agree with Senator Bershinger from a stewardship and long-term perspective of dedicated land ownership, we would be remiss to not actively reforest these timberlands, not only for, you know, the future value that it brings to our organization, but just the communities and you know, that we live in. And so more from a stewardship perspective, we agree with the perspective that, you know, we have to find a way to, as rapidly as possible, reforest these areas that were devastated in the severe and extreme fire intensity areas.
So we see
it's a burden for
right.
Not only small landowners, but, you know, also larger landowners. We're coming out of a recession. We're not the healthiest of organizations right now, and to add this additional burden, this economic burden, in addition to just the physical act of having to go reforest areas that we had actively and vigorously growing, it's a real burden for us. So any assistance that can be gained is certainly welcome, and we think it's great policy.
So do we have any expectation that the fire on the public lands, the BLM lands, is going to be reforested or taken care of in any way between now and the next 3 years?
I have an expectation that while you will see active and aggressive salvage and active management on the private lands, to the best of our ability for all the reasons we just talked about, we are not seeing that indication that that will happen to the same scale and robustness that on the public lands, just due to the federal policies and guidance and standards that those land managers are currently up against. The whole NEPA process is just disincentivizes the agency from actively managing those lands.
Okay. Any other questions for any of our panelists? Okay, I really appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing it. This is a committee bill, and so it's another one of those that we will pass on, and I look forward to seeing your final drafts as you keep moving forward with the with the work on this one. So thank you all for being here, and thank you on the phone for spending the time with us, and appreciate your comments and your knowledge on this particular issue.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep. So now I think we will move forward to the introduction of committee bills. We have one more bill to hear, but Senator Farioli is not available until about 10:15.
10.
Oh, so he should be about 10 o'clock. So I thought we might as well take care of our other committee business first. And so that would be introduction of committee measures. So Senator Bearsugar.
Chair Roblin, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 152, dated 1-10-2014, LC 156, dated 12-23-2013, LC 164, dated 1-10-2014.
So Senator Bearsugar moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 152, dated 1-10-2014, LC 156, dated 12-23-2013, and LC 164, dated 1-10-2014. And I like to make sure that I reiterate that if you actually vote to have these introduced as committee bills, it is no indication that you will be in favor of the bills when they come before a committee, which may or may not be this committee in the future. So, again, these are this is just the introduction to them, so they can be taken by the president's office and assigned to committees that they will be heard in, and then from there you can vote any way you wish if you voted on them today. So, with that admission, is there any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, they are introduced. And with that, let's take a short little recess, and then we'll come back as soon as I see Senator Farioli in the building. we actually have everybody we need, I think, here. So we're going to come out of our recess and open a public hearing on LC 6. Wow, it must be important. It's really down those low numbers. That's impressive. So call Education Funding Protection Act. And with that, I will turn it over to Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First of all, really appreciate the opportunity to present LC 6 to the committee as we get ready for our February short session. Calendars are getting pretty jammed up, so I regard this as being a consideration from the committee chair and members, and I thank you for that. LC 6 comes to us because of an issue that has occurred in Grant County, but also just throughout the state of Oregon. Acting under absolutely the best of intentions, organizations throughout the state of Oregon, nonprofits and others, non-governmental organizations have come forward with wonderful ideas that end up converting private land to public ownership. And there's just literally unnumbered organizations with great agendas that want to accomplish the preservation of habitat or the set aside of historic lands or the preservation of special places in Oregon, and that characterizes Oregonians. They really love the state, and they really love the heritage, and they want to see that those things are preserved and protected and carried forward for future generations. So the motives are great. The issue that is a sort of an unintended consequence is that is every one of these great intentions results in a reduction of potential tax base for local governments. And where that shows up is in police, fire protection, and most notably schools. We've watched a steady erosion of the tax base. We don't have any desire to prevent the preservation and protection of resources, natural resources, habitats, and historic and cultural resources, but the way in which they're protected does have implications for all of us as we go forward. We've tried to craft in LC 6 an opportunity for counties to suggest strongly, by ordinance, that if a conversion from a private land base ownership to a public base, which is tax exempt, is desirable, that it occur in such a way that the local tax base is protected. And that is by exchange or by the release of some similar asset that would protect the local tax base. So we're not saying don't do this conversion. What we're really saying is do it in such a way that we don't harm the schools, police, fire protection, and other public services. We're calling it the Education Funding Protection Act because the arguably one of the most important things that we do in government is fund our schools. We asked legislative council for an opinion, and the question was, do the counties have a vested interest and a legal right to protect their tax base? And the answer that came back from legislative council is, yes, in fact, they have a vested interest and perhaps even a duty to protect their tax base. Otherwise, they can't fund the health, peace, and safety services and the education services that is their duty to provide under the constitutional requirements. So what we did was said, what can we do to allow these counties to adopt an ordinance that would give them the authority to engage in the discussion about the conversion of private land to public land in such a way that they can direct the transaction, structure the transaction, so that the accomplishment of the goal isn't impeded at all, but at the end of the day, they haven't harmed the local tax base. And what we came up with the help of a lot of input from Ledge Council and stakeholders is the Education Funding Protection Act. It would only apply permissively, that is to say, counties would be allowed to adopt an ordinance like this, not mandated to do it. It would only apply to counties that have greater than 50% of land held in public ownership currently. and it would only apply in counties where there's less than 100,000 in population. So we tried to put some sideboards on this thing, and as it turns out, that amazingly, 32 out of 36 counties in the state of Oregon are either more than 50% publicly owned or have less than 100,000 population. So it applies to a lot of counties. Potentially. The objective is to ensure stable funding for critical public services. The objective is to empower the counties by allowing them to choose many different implementation options to accomplish the goal of preservation and protection without the loss of the tax base. It encourages land to be put into the highest and best productive use, and it reduces the inefficiency of just owning a lot of public assets with no income to pay for those. So we think there's a good reason for the legislature to take up this issue, have the appropriate debate, and possibly create a new tool for the toolbox of counties that, again, would allow them to accomplish the goals of preservation and protection without loss of tax base. So no net loss would require tax-exempt purchasers, non-governmental organizations, government agencies, and others, to put land of equal class and value back into the private land ownership base when they purchase or acquire tax-exempt land in any particular county. It's a sort of a what goes in must come out in terms of protecting the tax base. This is going to have a... another side stream benefit, which is to ask the counties to consider protecting their best outstandingly remarkable values, rather than just putting set-asides in for set-asides' sake. They're actually going to do some prioritization and possibly release some of the potentially lesser long-term value lands in exchange for those higher long-term value protections. So there's going to be a kind of a analysis process that'll be induced into this by LC6. And then there's some incentives to transfer private land from special assessment, like conservation easements, wildlife refuges, etc., that are lands that could be released. Those will go back on the regular tax rolls at full value. So at some point in time in the future, I hope we can look back at this bill and say what we did was put the counties at the table in land exchanges with the idea that a land exchange or a land transfer to public ownership will occur, but not at the expense of the local tax base. And when it occurs, the release of lesser value lands in terms of outstandingly remarkable value for higher outstandingly remarkable value lands occurs. So we are protecting the best and, you know, the most culturally important and the that which has the best long-term value for preservation. So I think there's a lot of upsides to this. I think it is an opportunity to create a new tool for counties, and at the end of the day, we will hopefully see the end of the erosion of the local tax base that supports schools and public services, police, fire, and et cetera. So that's what's at the heart of LC6. There's no emergency clause because there's no emergency. There's no attempt to interfere with currently ongoing acquisitions. You know, this bill would not go into effect until the usual and customary implementation dates. So we're not raising a red flag or waving a bloody shirt or pointing this in any particular transaction. We're just saying the trend of public conversion of private land has gone on for such a long period of time, it really is starting to affect the ability of local governments to sustain themselves, and we need to give them a tool that mitigates that conversion. And I've used too many words. This is a very simple concept. I'll be happy to have any questions from the committee that you care to ask.
Okay. I think we'll go through all testimony and then ask questions after that. So do you want to go to the county commissioners? So which of the two of you would like to start first?
Well, being the most bashful commissioner in the state, I guess I can go ahead and go first, if that's all right with Commissioner May.
It works. It works. Yeah. You know Senator Farielli fairly well, at least in one of the many counties that Senator Farielli represents. You are one of them. So yes.
I'm sure he can speak to how bashful I am. So Anyway, I'll go ahead and start again. Thank you, Senator Roblin, for allowing us to speak, and thank you, Senator Perioli, for bringing this forward. And just a quick little history.
Make sure you give your name at the beginning of this.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lloyd Burton, a Grant County Commissioner.
Thanks.
Anyway, Greg, can I start now, sir?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just a little bit of history. Grant County has been, in recent times, been really, really bleeding private lands. We just recently had a conversion of about 13,700 acres of the D.R. Johnson family private lands that was ceded over or purchased by the Rocky Mount Elk Foundation, and which it was in turn ceded over to the United States Forest Service. And also recently, it's not done complete, but it looks like EcoTrust of Portland is fixing to purchase 14,000 acres of Grant County, of private land that's in Grant County. It's not exactly private. It's owned by Hood River County, which has their own forestry program. Anyway, that's going to EcoTrust, and then currently on the books, y'all's organization, Oregon Parks and Rec Department, is in the process of purchasing 6,400 acres here for conversion to a park. Anyway, that's, you know, like 32,000 acres, and boom, in 1 year is going to go off our tax rolls. And these entities do have the capability of payment in lieu of taxes. However, that is their choice. They don't necessarily have to do it. My friend, and I really can't say this, my friend Russ Holtwood from the Nature Conservancy owns property here on the Middle Fork, and they do have consistently and willingly have paid PILT. But that's difficult for us to administer because we have over 26 different little taxing districts within Grant County that the assessor has to take care of. And when it goes into the general fund like that, where those PILT payments go, it's difficult for us to manage those dollars to take care of those little taxing districts, such as these schools. So that's one of our concerns, and Senator Perioli really hit it correctly when he said the law of unintended consequences. That's exactly what's happened. So many of these people have the best of intentions. They want to help Grant County. They want to preserve, you know, whatever habitat. I'm not sure exactly what all their intentions are, but I'm sure it's completely honorable. But it's hurting the county, and we're just being cut. And you think that, well, you know, 32,000 acres in an area the size of Grant County isn't that much, but it is when you consider that over 64% of our county is owned by the federal government or the state government. That leaves our tax base to be very, very small. So I think this legislation is a very, very good attempt at trying to keep county government whole so we can continue to provide the service to our citizens. So I'm going to leave it at that, and please, after Commissioner Maine's done, if you have any questions of me, I would love to attempt to answer them. And once again, Senator Roland, thank you for allowing me to speak.
Yeah, thank you. Bob?
Yes, this is Bob Maine. Thank you, Senator Rubble and Senator Perioli and members of the committee. I, too, am really concerned about the erosion of our tax base. Over 50% of Coos County is owned by one government agency or another. And in fact, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the last several years have started their abandoned marsh project. About 2 years ago, about 30 citizens and myself showed up at an informational meeting that was put on by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Bandon at the Bandon Library. And when I arrived, there were five armed officers for an unruly crowd of 30 people. And apparently what had happened, somebody called the Portland office and was not happy with this whole marsh thing. Portland apparently called Denver office and they called us troops, which is not within their purview. But they had five fully armed officers there at the meeting, standing in the back of the room with their arms, well, three in the back of the room with their arms crossed, and two outside in the dark looking in through the windows. At which point, I thought we were going to find out about the new Mars project. In reality, what happened was they decided to tell us how they were going to expand to another 4,500 acres from Bandon up to Riverton. And then sometime after the meeting, we learned that they were going to have plans to take all of the farmland clear up past Myrtle Point towards Powers, which is probably another 15 or 20,000 acres. Subsequent to that meeting, we, the county commissioners at that time, had a countywide vote on what people thought about the takeover by government of more property. 19,000 people voted no, which was about 70-plus percent of the voters, to say no more takeover, which apparently was then totally ignored because about 6 or 8 months later, the U.S. Forest Fish and Wildlife Service, in conjunction with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Nature Conservancy, and some wilderness groups out of Portland collaborated together to do a trade for some land that Bandon Biota owned in the bottomland farmland of the Coquille Valley, about 700 acres. What was proposed was a trade for ODFW timberland on Eel Lake of commensurate value for this farmland. What is scheduled for this farmland is to put a moat around it and have a muted tide gate, which allows water in at a certain level and water out at only a certain level. In other words, they're going to create a man-made lake of sorts to supposedly benefit ducks and fish and et cetera, except that if it's only 4 or 5 feet deep, it's going to heat up in the summertime and it's going to be a mosquito ground. And as you all maybe know, maybe you don't, the Bandon Marsh created a horrible mosquito problem. We even made national news where people within the 5 to 10 mile radius could not go outside of their homes last summer and fall because of the hordes of mosquitoes. We as county commissioners eventually pelletized, with the permission of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, at their expense, the abandoned, quote, marsh. But here this past month, I initiated and my other two commissioners supported the formation of a vector control where we have 10 citizens who will help us with the mosquito problem that we expect to happen, that we believe that they've spread all over the Bandon area, Bandon Dunes Golf Course, which provides about 600 jobs for our local folks. They even had to take drastic measures in their area to try and keep the mosquitoes down so that people don't slip off. So we think we're going to have a double marsh mosquito problem, one at the new one, and one of the existing ones that is spread out all over. So we are really up against it. As you know, it's probably not going to happen with any ONC funding. Looking at Senator Wyden's bill, it won't provide funding for the county. Representative DeFazio's bill would have provided adequate funding for the county, but it doesn't appear to have favor within the Senate. So what appears to happen is nothing's going to happen, and we are going to have to cut our personnel some more. We have gone from 530 employees to 290, and we will cut substantially further. We've tried to keep our law enforcement intact, but there's only a certain point at which we can keep funding without any money. So I guess in parting is that we're up against the wall here, as well as a lot of counties, for funding, and we can't survive with losing any more property off the tax rolls.
Thank you very much, Bob. We have another South Coast person. Oh, Jim Green from North Bend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. As the chairman has so aptly pointed out, I did grow up in North Bend down in Coos County. I'm now here in Marion County. But I want to thank Senator Farioli for bringing this issue forward. Each year, we travel around the state and do 20 regional meetings and meet with our members across the state. And as we traveled out to rural Eastern Oregon, one of the things we heard consistently from our members is we need to do something with the erosion of our public lands. They're seeing them go off the books, which means property tax and property tax dollars aren't there for our school districts. We have counties such as Lake County that have 78% of their lands are owned by some sort of governmental entity. And when you take those off the property tax rolls, that means an erosion of funding. You've heard from the county commissioners, you've heard from Senator Farioli. School districts are those taxing entities. And as you take them off, whether it's for the right reasons or not, and we're not saying that there's not good public policy behind why we've done this across the state. We want to preserve our natural resources, but we're seeing the erosion of dollars at our school level like we haven't seen before. And while we've tried to work with the Congress on getting more dollars for the Secure Rural Schools Act, that's the federal forest receipts dollars, and we had worked with counties in the past where we would share those revenues through the County Roads Fund. Grant County was an example of that. We're seeing lands being taken off the rolls, and it's a concern. And it should be a concern not only for those rural counties, but it should also be a concern for our metro areas, because the way our state school fund operates, when you take property tax dollars off in one taxing area, that's backfilled by the state school fund. Because remember, after ballot measure 5, all local property taxes are an offset against the state school fund. So when you reduce property tax valuation for one school district in Grant County, it has impact across the state. And I think it's an opportunity for us to begin this discussion about what we do with our public lands and what we do to protect the services that Senator Farioli and the county commissioners talked about. I represent school districts and education service districts. They're seeing an erosion, and we want to make sure that a conversation is held so that when you talk about good public policy with regard to our natural resources, you also take a look at economic development and what we're doing in those communities related to our public schools. And we believe this is an opportunity to have that conversation. We thank Senator Farioli for bringing it forward. And if you look at the bill, it doesn't require counties to adopt this ordinance. It's up to the county, to the county courts, the county commission to do it. And I would assume that counties, school districts, and other taxing entities would sit down at the table and have conversations about, do we want to do this? Do we not want to do this? And there are some exemptions that Senator Farioli's put in the bill with regard to eminent domain. You'll remember in Lakeview, y'all built a jail down there, a prison down there, and Lakeview wanted that. This would not impact those type of properties, but it would impact the ones where there is public land going to private use, or private land going to public use and taking it off those tax rolls. So we're very supportive of this idea. We believe it kicks off the conversation about what we do, and it impacts every school district across the state, not just ones that may be in Grant County or Wallowa County. It impacts Portland. It impacts my school district. For those of you that don't know, I'm also a locally elected official. I'm chair of the Salem-Keizer School Board this year, and we look here in Salem. And unfortunately, we wouldn't qualify under the bill, but some of our largest buildings, you're sitting in one of them right now that we don't receive any property tax dollars for in the Salem-Keizer School District. Up and down this mall are our largest office buildings, and we receive nothing for that. And I think it's an opportunity to have a conversation. Happy to answer any questions.
So any questions from our committee? Yes, Senator Krasinski.
Jim, as you mentioned, this would be good for urban as well as rural. I'm also, because of the tax base, you know, the urban renewal districts seem to have caused a lot of havoc in urban areas. So do you think that's something that should also be readdressed or reassessed as to the impact it has on not only school districts, but also these other taxing authorities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prozanski, yes, we do. Several sessions ago, you all passed a bill that requires when an urban renewal district is going to go out and alter its boundaries that they have to talk to those taxing districts that it impacts. That was a good step forward with regard to that, because urban renewal districts are created to go into areas, what are called blight areas, and provide economic development. Now, in some entities, I would argue that they haven't used that in the proper fashion. Right. And I think that's why the legislature stepped forward and said, if you're going to extend these, if you're going to make alterations to them, you need to talk to those taxing entities. We had that occur right here in Salem-Keizer with the Keizer Station property out north of the freeway, where they wanted to extend their urban renewal district. They had to come to us as the Salem-Keizer School District and talk to us about that. We were able to sit down and negotiate an agreement. I think the urban renewal districts and what we use urban renewal dollars for need to be looked at as well. But I think this is an opportunity for those areas that don't have a lot of urban renewal districts to have the discussion about what happens when you take property taxes off the roll and the impact that it has.
Okay. Other questions for any of our guests?
Yes, Mr. Farrell. Chairman, just in sum, Associated Oregon Counties debated and support this issue. They've adopted they've gone through their process of analysis and are in support of the bill. We're going to be outreaching to other entities as we go forward between now and the February session coming. This bill could easily be misconstrued as an attempt to prevent the further preservation of the lands. And I want to make sure people understand by putting this on the record. Oregon's a leader in protecting its natural resources and cultural heritage. We're a leader in land use issues. There's no intent to dissuade or deter a continuation of preservation and protection of our best resources. But we really need to recognize that there are several Oregon counties teetering on the brink of economic disaster. Curry, Coos, Douglas, Lane even, Wheeler in eastern Oregon, Jackson, a number of counties who've simply hit the wall in terms of available resources. And yet, within those same counties, we see a continuous erosion of their local tax base. So, under the rubric of doing wise land use planning and protection of our best resources, we need to provide the counties with an opportunity to structure these transactions so that the objective is met of continuing Oregon's great heritage of protection and preservation of cultural resources and our special places, but also recognize that that has a negative impact on the tax base, and it's probably time that we also created a mechanism to preserve and protect the ability of local governments to provide services to citizens. So by careful structuring, these transactions can continue to go forward, protecting the best resources that we have for the future, but also protecting our ability to provide those services. So it's a new tool, it's permissive, counties like it. We think we should give them an opportunity to have this ability. And when we've implemented it for a while and have a track record, then we could take another look at what's going on inside urban growth boundaries to see if it has application inside cities. To answer Senator Prozanski's question.
So my only other question is, what about people who have estates that have already figured out their will and whatever, and they've set it as a trust and they're going to give it to some organization? Would that then trip the county into figuring out what they're going to trade for?
Well, the conversions can occur. Okay. And nothing would impede that process, but the beneficiary or the recipient, whether it's a nature conservancy or a trust or the federal government or a park district or whomever, would be invited to sit down and structure that conversion so that when that private land comes off the tax roll, something of equal value goes back on the tax roll. And what I anticipate will happen is that there will be many transactions that occur that are structured with multiple partners so that at the end of the day the objective is met but the county doesn't lose its revenue.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to our two commissioners that came and spent the time with us today.
Thank you.
Senator Rowland, can I make one more quick comment?
Absolutely.
Sir, again, remember the way that Senator Ferrioli has this legislative structured is that ultimately the counties would have, in the end, their choice whether or not to enact an ordinance to implement it. So I think that I like that, where it gives the county kind of a free rein on their own fate, so to speak. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up to everybody's attention, and thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, and just for the record, that was Bob Britton, commissioner from Grant County. Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to close that public hearing. I don't think there's any more business for our committee. Is there anything, comments from anyone? I appreciate all you being here and getting our work done. And with that, we will adjourn our Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee hearing. Development.